Welcome to The Roofer Show with your host, Dave Sullivan. You found the podcast that helps roofing contractors grow their businesses, make more money, and have more free time. Each week, Dave interviews the industry's top experts who will give you actionable tips and strategies for the real world of construction to help you take your roofing business to the next level. So let's get down to business.
Hey, roofing contractors. Welcome to The Roofer Show, the place to be if you want to grow a more profitable roofing business. I'm your host, Dave Sullivan, and I've been a successful roofing contractor for over 30 years, and I'm here to share with you what I've learned. You can find more tips, strategies, and free downloads by going to my website at theroofershow.com. We have a great topic and interview today. We're going to give you everything you need to know about what is probably the third biggest cost in your roofing business, and that's your business insurance. Hey, wake up out there. Yeah, we're talking insurance today, but most of you may be saying, what's the big deal? My buddy's been handling all my insurance for years. Handles my auto, homeowners, and even life insurance. Hey, he's a great guy. Why shouldn't he handle my business insurance? He gets a couple of quotes, and I go with the cheapest one, and it's done. Well, we're going to get into why that might not be the best decision for your roofing business, with how you can choose the right insurance broker and why it matters. Our guest today is John Heinzen with Wells Fargo Insurance Services in the San Francisco Bay Area. John's been with Wells Fargo for over 25 years. They are the fourth largest insurance broker in the world with over 200 offices. John specializes in contractors and has been my broker for over 15 years and is someone who really knows both the insurance and construction businesses. I've had a number of brokers over the years, and like so many things, I had to learn the hard way when we found out that we weren't actually covered for a certain type of loss. And that's been the source of putting a lot of contractors out of business. So let's jump into the interview with John Heinzen. Hey, John, thanks for coming on the show today. What's going on?
Not much. Glad to be here, though.
Okay, great. So I'd say, what, we go back about 20 years we've been working together?
Yeah, give or take. I guess it's been about that long.
Yeah, we've had a few mishaps in those times, and but I've certainly learned a lot. I wanted to have you on the show today that we can talk about how to select a good insurance broker and why it matters. Because I know so many guys that they've got their agent that does their cars and their homeowners, life insurance, and so forth. And as they're growing their business, they just seem to stay on with them rather than moving on to somebody that specializes in construction like yourself. So just wanted to know, what's the problem with just going with your local agent that handles your auto insurance?
Well, in construction insurance, there's a lot of very specialized issues that require a lot of extra knowledge that the typical putting together a policy on homeowners and autos and so forth comes nothing close to touching. One of the biggest areas, or the most complicated area of insurance is construction, because of all the requirements and indemnity agreements, construction language, that type of thing. The industry tagline is, well, if you can do construction, you can do anything.
Yeah, I can believe that.
It's not only a knowledge issue, it's also a relationship issue. In other words, brokers that specialize in construction have the relationships with the right underwriters who can get the right terms and conditions, can negotiate the clauses and requirements that you need to meet your contract obligations. Mm-hmm. It's also important to have someone who can look at a construction agreement before you sign it, to make sure that it's compliant or congruent with the insurance coverage that you have. Mm-hmm. A great deal of contracts I've seen over the years get signed by someone who's eager to get the job, and they end up obliging themselves to a whole bunch of things that you just hope never happen. But, you know, the old saying is, if something can go wrong, it certainly will. And that certainly can lead to a lot of problems down the road.
That's always tough to walk away from those jobs, I tell you. You know, it's like, okay, well, roll the dice on this one, and usually doesn't go very well.
Well, if you have someone that knows to review the contracts, often what I've been able to do is I've been able to point out some onerous restrictive indemnity agreements that the people that are putting the contract forward have no concern about it. Just someone gave them that contract. So what you do, you go back, you say, hey, I want to do the job for you, but my insurance broker says, hey, this needs to be modified a little bit. In most cases, I've rarely heard a case where they'll readily agree to modify it.
You're right.
You end up not incurring liability exposures that you shouldn't have to honor or be concerned about.
So that's something that you guys take care of, that you'll take a look at some of these contracts and hopefully avoid some problems down the road.
Absolutely, we do. We do that all the time.
Great. All right, let's jump into the types of insurance coverages, because I know this is an area where, as roofers, we've got some pretty specialized coverages and a lot of things that can go wrong. And I should first say that we're in California here, and these things apply to California. And if you're living outside of California, you want to check your insurance regulations there.
Yeah, one of the things that you'll find in general liability, for example, is that in California, the laws are so restrictive that a lot of times contracts require additional insured agreements that are not, that carriers are not willing to provide. And so you'll see contract languages that say that way you have to have the additional insured 2010-1115. And then you'll find out the carriers don't want to offer that. Mm-hmm. You can offer alternative. So there are ways of getting around these issues, but you just have to know about them.
Yeah, getting the additional insured is a lot harder than it used to be, I guess. We used to get those all the time and wasn't a problem. But these days, I guess there's just so much additional liability the carriers don't want to offer them.
They do. It's just that they don't want to offer that form. And so what my point is that contracts sometimes often require those types of things that are no longer available, as long as that is known and can be looked at, then you can get around that problem. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
I got you. Sounds like your local Allstate agent's not going to know most of these things.
No, and they're not going to have a place to place that. What they do is they have to place all their business with, let's say that they're an Allstate agent, they have to place it all with Allstate. Now, they usually get the provision of, well, if Allstate doesn't want to do it, then they can place it elsewhere. But they have to go to typically the surplus lines market. They don't have any market clout because the carriers that are the quality carriers will only deal with brokers that sign contracts with them, and that contract obligates them to provide X amount of business, which is considerably more than a direct writer like a Farmers or a State Farm or Allstate agent would ever be able to commit to. So
Right. They're
going to be completely out of the marketplace that matters.
Can you give us a quick difference between an agent and a broker?
Yeah, the agent is a direct representative of the insurance company, whereas a broker, the primary legal responsibility is with the client, with a secondary relationship to the insurance company.
So you're
obviously would prefer to be with a broker if you can.
Right. So your agent's not particularly working for you. They're working for the carrier, which is not a good thing.
Well, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but being a broker is definitely a better thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's jump into workers' comp, which is the first one, which everybody loves. So can you give us, how are the rates determined these days for starters?
Well, the rates are used to be determined by the Rating Bureau. In 1995, I believe it was, that we went to open rating. But the Bureau still collects all the data by class codes and then uses that data to come up with a set of rates by classification that covers, that is adequate to cover the claims that they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So then the individual carriers have what they call an LCF, loss conversion factor, that they apply to those base rates. And from there, then they come up with their rates. And so they're free to manipulate those rates any ways they want.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're evaluating a carrier, one of the things that we do is to commonly examine those LCF factors so that we can know which carriers are going to be more competitive in representing your interest.
Mm-hmm. And I assume it's the same as it's been in the past, that there's generally only two or three markets that you can go to for workers' comp in California, at least.
Well, there's a lot of different markets for different things, but insurance companies are just like any other company. They don't try to offer the be-all, end-all for everybody. And so just like everybody that's in business, if they want to succeed, they have to find a niche so that they can carve out that niche, become an expert at it, in that niche, and really understand it. Mm-hmm. Because one of the key issues from an insurance company is underwriting. If you underwrite a whole bunch of the same type of accounts, you'll get to understand it and you'll get to have your rates very close to what the actual success rate should be. But if you're trying to be a market for everybody, then you're not going to be successful, and you end up, when you're not being familiar with your risk, you end up charging more. Just you have to have a cushion of comfort.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the XMOD, the experience modification, because that's a huge thing that we learned the hard way, and that's where that safety program really comes in. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yes, yeah, so I said the Rating Bureau monitors all the claims activity by class code for all the various carriers. For each individual account that is qualifies for experience rating, and I believe that's a premium of like $25,000 over a three-year period of time. So most significant businesses are all experience rated. Then they take all that data and compare it to the average and determine an average loss experience for the average, let's say, roofer in that case. And then they assign that arbitrarily the number 1.0, or we call it unitary. So then those accounts that are rated that come in with a better claims experience, they get a discount factor. And those that are adverse to that mark then have a mod in excess of 1.0. And the key thing in California is to know that the cutting line is 1.25, because once you get a modification factor above 1.25, then you draw the attention and scrutiny of the regulatory agencies, namely CalOSHA.
Right.
And then they are required to monitor your behavior, and they charge you a fee to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the key is understanding in all aspects of insurance that you pay your own claims. This is something that is very poorly misunderstood. They think that if they can buy insurance and if they have claims, then it goes to the insurance company. Well, most people that have been around a little bit know that when you have claims activity, then you end up getting higher premiums the next time around.
Right.
And the same thing it's effectively the same thing with the experience mod. When you have a lot of claims activity, your mod goes up and then your pricing goes up.
Right. Well, I was just saying that tends to carry with you too. It's not just a one-year deal, but that X mod, once you get up there, it's tough to get back down.
Well, yeah, it's a slow-moving thing. Like I like to express it as an anaconda sucking down a goat. It takes a while to get through the process. But anyways, the period, since you mentioned that, is 40 months, as I recall. They don't count the most recent 12 months because they figure claims activity is still gelling and being worked out, and so that it's not reliable data.
Mm-hmm.
But so what they do is they use the data preceding that for 40 months, excuse me. And that data is all put together into your mod factor. So if you have a significant claim and it hits year one, then it'll hit year two and it'll hit year three.
Right.
So one of the things to be aware of is when you're dealing with claims, sometimes a smaller claim can end up costing you more than if you'd end up paying it out of your own pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to be careful and to be clear on that, you can only pay claims out of your own pocket if they are first aid.
Right.
And first aid is clearly defined by the rating bureau now.
Right, right. So if let's say I've got a premium of 100 grand and now I've got an X mod, I've got that down, and well, we start off at 100 at 1, and if I can get that down to 0.7, then I just save myself $30,000. Instead of the $100,000, I'm now paying $70,000. Is that correct?
Well, I think that's definitely true, but more to the point, I think you can definitely put more profit. Yeah, that's the way I'm looking at it. In other words, it creates a competitive advantage with your competitors. So when you're in a bidding situation, you can bid more effectively and much more successfully.
Yeah.
Not to mention the fact that if you have a lower X mod, that speaks well with a lot of general contractors. As a matter of fact, some of the larger general contractors won't even talk to you if you have a mod factor over 1.5, and certainly not over 1.25.
Right.
So
right.
It becomes not only a profit situation, it becomes a qualification for the work factor.
Yeah. I don't think people realize how the cost savings that's really in there. I mean, I know some guys that are up at 1.3, 1.4. I mean, that's an extra 30 grand, 40 grand instead of paying $100,000.
Well, the smart contractors tend to say, okay, what do I do about this? In other words, there are contractors that say, oh, well, that happened and that damn employee or this or that, or, you know, so making up some sort of excuse. Rather than taking the issue seriously and saying, okay, I've got a problem, how do I deal with this? And this is one of the big differentiators between brokers, is most brokers do not offer any ability to deal with claims problems.
Mm-hmm.
Only the better brokers offer auxiliary services, and they offer them typically at no extra cost to you, but as an inducement to win business and also to retain it.
Right.
So what I'm talking about, well, you have two things. You have claim prevention. And so the way that brokers offer service in this regard is to offer on-staff loss control people who will go out, evaluate your safety program, go to job sites, note how safety practices are being ignored or being used and doing it correctly, and they can give you evaluations. It's important to understand the difference between a broker-supplied loss control versus what many brokers depend upon, and that is a loss control person on the carrier side. On the carrier side, they typically are not as well educated or as capable, because the capable ones want to work for the better brokers and they get paid better.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when you're dealing with a carrier loss control person, everything they find gets immediately reported to the underwriter, which
right.
is not their best interest.
Mm-hmm.
So you're better off having someone that's on your side so you can freely discuss what issues you're going through so that you can arrange solutions, and none of that information goes to the insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
The second area is when you've had a claim occur, then most brokers do not provide any kind of facilities to deal with those claims, to move them through the system, to draw attention to where claims could be handled better, more effectively by the claims adjusters. So again, that's a big thing. One of the key times, dates with regard to your workers' comp carrier coverage is called the unit statistical period, which is 6 months prior to your renewal date. Most people don't, when I mention that, don't even know what it is.
Right.
And they're surprised because all they're ever focused on is the renewal date.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by then, you know, the proverbial cow has gotten out of the barn.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing you can do. You can't change the data. So I've seen successful stories with some of my clients when we've dealt with unit statistical periods, and we've looked and examined. In one case, we found 4 open claims that we found hadn't been getting enough attention, and so we were able to close them, all 4 of them, just prior to the unit statistical date when the claims were filed with the rating bureau, And I estimate that probably saved them 10 points on their mod. Right. So those auxiliary services, which most brokers don't provide, are very crucial.
Yeah, I know that. That was a great service that you had for us. I mean, we were really on top of those claims. And most contractors just really don't understand it. They think it's whatever happens, happens. But you can really get those things under control and really clamp them down. And whether it's through alternate work programs, we've had some guys come back that can do something else. But the big thing is just getting them back to work, because the longer the claim's going on, the less likely that they're ever going to come back to work or get off that disability.
Well, I can tell you this, that if you're looking to know when shyster lawyers are advertising, you'll find that it's on daytime television and your injured worker is sitting at home with a clicker. Getting well entertained.
Yeah, and once they get the attorney involved, it's a whole nother world.
Absolutely.
Let's get into the general liability, and Let's talk about that, and really what your broker needs to know when it comes to general liability for roofing contractors.
Well, what I started, we've covered part of this already before with the indemnity agreements and the additional insureds language and so forth, but there's some other things to be aware of. If we're talking contractors such as roofing or siding or those areas where there's water intrusion, then you've got a big concern with mold.
Right.
Mold is, like I like to say, like a pancake mix. All you do is add water.
Yeah.
Because it's every place. So a fair amount of roofers or contractors with that exposure, plumbers are another one, tend to purchase liability coverage without thought to the pollution coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you're dealing in many of these cases, especially roofers, with materials that can be pollutants to some individuals. And if they're misused or they're allowed to dissipate into space where they cause damage to land or streams, I've seen all of these types of things happen. Then you've got those big, it's quite a significant cleanup mess.
Well, it's huge. And these are exclusions in so many policies, right?
Right. And the other thing that we're seeing, more so on the general construction side, but we're seeing more and more contracts requiring professional liability or errors and omissions coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, all designs are done by architects. The architects, of course, are licensed. They're held in terms that are licensed, they're held to higher responsibility for their work. And so they typically take the exposure and then they have their own professional liability coverage.
Mm-hmm.
But what we find is very often, in fact, it's probably more common than not, individual contractors are taking the plans and then they're finding that such and such solution elaborated by the architect isn't really workable. And so they decide to do it a little bit different.
Right.
And that can put them in that place. It's sort of like anything else. It's a matter of money. In other words, if it's not a lot of money, most carriers will probably just pick it up as general liability, completed operations exposure, and not fuss with it. But if it's a lot of money, then they very well say, well, that's not a liability exposure, that's a professional liability exposure, so we're declining the claim. So it's an area that is becoming more prominent now than it has been in recent years.
So that's just something your broker should be aware of, and again, if they're not familiar with construction, you may be out of luck.
Well, yeah, what I've seen is I've actually talked to general contractors that when I've talked to them, I asked them about that, and they say, oh, no, we don't need that. But then I can bring to their attention, well, wait a minute, the other department just 2 doors down that deals with all your contracts and everything, it keeps requesting certificates of liability insurance for the professional to be included.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, a lot of times the decision maker on the insurance isn't even aware that the requirements are not being met and they're being asked for. And so a lot of times they can get around them, but sometimes they can't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's to wrap up here. What are some ways that our contractors can save some money? Because that's something that they're looking to do. I know one thing that we looked at was making sure that we weren't overcovered, for instance, with our equipment and so forth. We'd have to come up, we could get the value correct rather than just throwing a number at it. And that would always save us a lot of money. Are there some other things that they can do?
Well, I don't see very often that overcoverage is much of an issue. I think the key issue there is to have someone acting as your broker that would carefully evaluate all of your values and the type of coverage you have. For example, an awful lot of people insure their buildings, intending that something happens to the building, it will be replaced, but they keep using the same value they've used for 10 years, despite the fact that a lot of things have changed.
Right.
And so the way to do that is there is a U.S.-wide industry acceptable formula called the Marshall-Swift. And if you have a good loss control person, they can run a Marshall-Swift on your buildings and determine what the valuation are. Now, what that does is you can take that appraisal, if you will, to the insurance companies, and based on that, they will accept that, and they will give you broader coverage. So you end up getting better coverage, and you have the security of knowing that you are properly insured. And what I'm talking about is that they will waive any co-insurance penalties, which is a very nice thing. The other thing to be aware of that can make a big difference in a claim is to be sure you have building ordinance coverage. In other words, a building is built and municipal ordinances and so forth change all the time. And building codes require changes to be made in construction, even in repair after a certain amount of destruction. So those are some other issues. As far as saving money, the best thing to do, frankly, it's very simple. It's simply to have less claims and to have all your protective ducks in a row. In other words, you're doing your safety meetings, you're following up, you're not just giving lip service to it. I've seen a situation where the general contractor was going in and he had a guy that was giving all the safety programs and all the paperwork ever looked great. But what it turned out is it wasn't being translated into the job site. So they were a mess.
Right.
And so what it was doing, it was dry labbing it. So if you're going to do a safety program, it has to be monitored. It has to be enforced. It can make a big difference. So if you end up with that kind of a program, well monitored, well structured, you're going to save a lot of money.
Yeah.
You're going to get lower workers' comp cases. You're going to have lower liability cases. That's your absolute best way to save money.
Yep. And, well, I know that you guys saved us a lot of money in that area when the guys would come out to the job, talk directly with our people and do the inspections. And that was a huge thing. We had a good safety program, and we've always been well under 100, down in the low 50s at some points. And that's a huge...
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, and that's a huge cost advantage over your competitors.
Another thing that can help is on that, is having a loss control person will go to talk to the troops. I've been told that a lot of times they can talk to the troops, but you're Joe Blow and they know you and everything, but it carries more weight when they have this outside guy that comes in as a quote-unquote expert.
Right.
So they'll tend to listen to that more.
Yep.
You have some potential also to do loss incentive things and so forth, but they're not quite as effective in the construction area as they are in the manufacturing area.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's some great information, John. And what's the best way to reach out to you?
Well, you can always call me, which I always like, and that is at 925-899-2953. And my email is john.heinson@wellsfargo.com.
All right. Well, that sounds great. Well, I sure appreciate you coming on the show today and giving us all that information. And we will see you soon. Thanks so much.
Great.
All right.
Glad to be here.
Take care, John. Thanks. Now it's time for our business quick tip. Each week, I'll give you a quick business tip that worked for me and my company, and it just might work for you. In today's interview with John, we talked about the importance of a low experience modification on your workers' comp. problems with a high mod rate are really bad news. So let's list off these nasties. Number one, it's a real competitive disadvantage. Crappy mod has a long tail, and one bad year can really affect the rate you're paying for a long time. Number two, an accident not only disrupts your production and your crew's psyche, but the cost to replace an injured worker is something we constantly talk about. Where are you going to find them? Number three, besides potential OSHA hearings and fines, you'll notice they are hanging around a lot more and making more surprise inspections. If you have to go in front of OSHA to explain an accident, a good mod will go a long way to getting the fines reduced, and vice versa. Number four, some prospects will disqualify you for a high mod. We did a lot of refinery work, and they required a very low rate, and the competition was very limited, as most contractors couldn't meet the requirements, and that was some good work for us. Number five, you miss out on a great marketing opportunity by showing your prospects why a good safety record means that you take care of your employees, which translates into more care for their property and a good job. These are some of the things that we did with our safety program to keep our mod rate under 80%. Sometimes we'd get it as low as the low 70s. It wasn't a big, complicated safety program that no one could understand, let alone implement. But like everything we did, we kept it simple, but very consistent, focusing on the basics and doing them really well every day. Number one, a safety attitude from the top down, not just paying lip service, but making it a top priority. Number two, the most productive thing we did was have a simple checklist called the Safety Perfect 10. I was very big on checklists, as you can see throughout these podcasts. They're simple and easy to understand. We used a perfect 10 form for a lot of things. We took the top 10 safety items that we wanted to focus on and listed them out on the form. Every time one of our superintendents or even myself visited the job site, we would fill out the checklist. We'd have fall protection in place, ladders tied off, bad extension cords. Now, those were simply just cut in half to let everybody know we were serious. It was quick but effective. The crew got a copy, and one went into the job file. Occasionally, I'd take out a stack of $20 bills and pass them out if they got a perfect 10. I always like the carrot over the stick. Works a lot better. If you want a copy of our safety perfect 10, you can just contact me and I'll get you a copy. Number three, monthly safety meetings. We made them fun to keep their attention, and we always had a raffle, and a lottery scratcher tickets that everybody loved were great, and so were the $20 bills. Number four, weekly toolbox talks from the foreman. You can get a stack of 52 topics from most of the associations, but they're simple, and you can document them. Number five is training. It's worth spending the money to send your people to programs like those offered by the NRCA. They have certifications that can also be used to differentiate yourselves to your prospects. Number six, hire a professional safety inspector on a per-inspection basis. As we went over in our interview, hopefully you have a broker that provides this service for you for free. It's a great value, and we had one. He worked with the guys, particularly at the job setup. It got a lot of complicated jobs started off on the right foot. Number seven, there are plenty of resources out there, and many of them are free. Use them. Videos that are great for new hires to go through before they even get on the roof. Eight, and last and most important, I'm repeating myself, but make it simple and consistent. Everyone needs to understand that safety is everyone's concern, not something that is just a pain in the ass that has to be done. That's it for today's show. If you want to get a copy of my new guide, 7 Steps to Getting More Qualified Leads for Your Roofing Business, go to my website at theroofershow.com, where you can grab it for free or click on the link in the show notes below. And as always, thank you for listening. I really, really appreciate it. We'll see you next time on The Roofer Show.